to the Gridiron Growl Podcast from ChopTalk.com.
You're listening to the Gridiron Growl Podcast. My name is Jay Kidd. Alongside with me is publisher and headman at ChopTalk.com, Brian Fox, brought to you by Chomp Talk. We're here to discuss the Kentucky-Florida game. Obviously, Florida losing 20-13 on the road. Now their second loss of the season and their second loss in the conference. They now sit at 1-2, 1-1 in the SEC East. Brian, how you doing?
I'm doing good, man. Better than I think that football team looked yesterday.
That was
a tough one to watch, man. We've talked long and hard about the offensive acumen of Dan Mullen, and we really didn't see a whole lot from this offense yesterday.
Yes, exactly. And we'll get into that a little bit. Not the best showing for Florida. First thing I want to mention, probably the biggest thing that comes out of this, penalties, most under Dan Mullen. 15 penalties for 115 yards with 8 false starts, 10 on the offense. Brian, I actually did some digging. This is the most This is the most penalties a Dan Mullen coach team has ever had, not just in his career, but on the road as well. And it's actually the most offensive penalties they've had. And that's dating back all the way back to 2018 when they played Mississippi State. And Fred Johnson led the way with 3 false starts that night.
Yeah. And how surprising is it that this is coming at Kentucky? You know, this is a program that's used to playing at Texas A&M last year, at Tennessee every other year, at LSU every other year. And they have these kind of communication issues on the offensive line between the offensive line and the quarterback at Kentucky. Look, I get Kentucky was sold out, but it was still Kentucky. It was still 2/3 of the crowd that you would have seen at Kyle Field at Texas A&M. That's one of the biggest surprises to me. I expected a loud and raucous crowd. I expected it to affect Emory Jones, but I didn't expect the offensive line to be impacted quite the way that they were.
Yeah, it was just weird. You know, we've been patting the offensive line on its back for, you know, 4 weeks now. Now we get to this one, and they just communication issues, can't block anybody. Kingsley Eguikong looked like he was in jail for most of the night. Just did not look like the unit that we've seen throughout the year. And you know, people wonder, you know, what do you do to adjust to that? Do you go to the silent count? Do you try and mix up the snap count? It was just weird. It's just weird to not see an adjustment get made there either. Yeah. So, what are we going to say?
No, I completely agree with you on all counts there. John Hevesy has some explaining to do when he's available to the media, if he's available to the media.
Yeah, we'll get to talk to him, I think. But another thing that was very surprising was special teams was very subpar this game. They factored in the penalties as well. DeJuan Black had a personal foul penalty on the first punt of the game by Kentucky, I believe. That turned a 35-yard punt into a 50-yard punt. Also, Damian Pierce getting called for offsides on kick coverage. And then the next kick comes out and misses the tackle coming down the field. And then obviously the big one, the blocked field goal of Jace Chrisman returned for a touchdown. First block kick since 2015 in the SEC title game. First one returned back for a score. Charlie Strong was coaching the Peach Bowl in 2004.
That's good research, man. That's going hey, back, that's isn't
not,
it?
That's not just research. That is what they give me in the game notes, Brian.
Nah, that's phenomenal. Hey, by the way, it was a rough night for special teams. I am curious what your take is. Jace Chrisman knocks in a 51-yard kick, no problem, through the uprights, did it after a penalty that set it back to the 51-yard mark. He obviously looks like the better kicker, right?
I don't know, man. PATs are like, it's I've seen your take on this. It's so weird to think that, like, oh, we can make the field goals. Why can he not also make the PATs? Like, it could be like one thing. Like, you don't focus like once, or you just angle your foot the wrong way and it just goes left or goes right. Like, you know, I don't know if it's the fact that Chrisman might be the better kicker, but who knows?
Yeah, I mean, we'll get into coaching and issues with that a little bit later, I'm sure. No, but you're right. It was a rough night for special teams. The errors, you mentioned the Daiwan Black one. That one's one that's just inexcusable, and there's no reason for it. It's done by a guy who's barely getting on the field anyway, so you would think that he would do everything he can to, you know, stay on the good graces of the coaching staff, and this is just going to put him further down the depth chart. You know, it's odd because these aren't the same mistakes that we've been seeing. This is like a whole new set of issues that we're seeing from this Florida football team, and we haven't been very used to that.
Yeah, I've mentioned to somebody that special teams, while it hasn't wowed people, you know, they're not getting the punt blocks, they're not getting which they did have the extra point on that kick return block, but they're not getting punt blocks, not blocking field goals, but they're also not giving the ball away on special teams. They're also at some point, you know, throughout Dan's career, have gotten the ball back on special teams as well. And they've utilized punting really well in their coverage team, you know, to pin teams back and get that good field position for their defense. So it's not that it's been, you know, outstanding. You're not getting, you know, the big splash plays, but you're also not, it's not costing you games. This is the first time it really has this year. Another thing that we're not used to seeing struggle a little bit, the Florida offense. Yes, 382 yards of total offense, but 13 points on the board to show for it. Could have been more, but Florida just not really able to get it in the end zone. They were only 4 of 13 on third down, dominated almost every statistic offense-wise, but did not do it where it counted, which was the scoreboard. Brian, your take on the offense.
You know, I've seen a lot of takes on social media that, you know, obviously Emory Jones is being handcuffed right now, that they're only letting him do so much and that they're just not calling the plays. I've heard from people that were at the game that that's drastically different, that there were deep routes that Emory just didn't throw them for whatever reason. Maybe it's Emory handcuffing himself. I don't know how true that is. That's just what I'm hearing. Otherwise, I didn't think that the offense, you know, the Emory interception, that was not a good interception. It came back to bite them a little bit. But overall, I mean, when you look at his numbers, 23 for 31, 203 yards. That's not a bad stat line. That's the kind of stat line that I think a lot of people expected and would have been happy with going into the game. The running game, you still piled up 171 yards. You did that largely against a team that sat eight people in the box. They challenged Florida to throw the ball, and Florida did 31 times. It was funny. So in watching the game, I was sitting with my brother. I told him when Florida was making that final drive, I said, Florida needs something deep here. They need to score relatively fast and from a little ways out because it is so much harder when you've got 22 people inside the red zone there to find that space and get in the end zone. As soon as they got into the red zone and as soon as they got down into the 10 yard line area, I told him, I said, this is going to be significantly more difficult than if they had just taken a shot from the 40. Sure enough, Florida doesn't score there. We all know how that ended, but overall, I mean, they have to find a way to score in the red zone when the running game is not as effective as you would hope. But overall, I thought the offense, they didn't play their worst game, but obviously they didn't play their best. I would have liked to have seen more vertical opportunities, but that's something that's going to be between Dan Mullen and Emory Jones, and that's something that Dan Mullen's probably never going to share with the media as far as Emory's misses deep or whatever. So if you know anybody at the game, if they told you the same thing, I've heard it for the last couple of weeks, but that's just what I'm hearing. Jake, what's your take, man?
Yeah, Emory Jones, I looked up this website. They keep, you know, in these advanced stats, they have a depth of field target chart that I looked at. And I don't know what you consider deep, but they didn't have a single completion past 20 yards. They did have 11 or 12 of Emory's throws were past the first down marker at least 11 yards. Like you're saying, you're either not being called or Emory's just not throwing them. And it's just weird. You mentioned the red zone trips. They only had three all game, and they scored on two of them. The only one they didn't score on was the one they had nine plays from the 10 and couldn't punch it in. They have 20 red zone trips on the year, and I think they've scored touchdowns in 13 of them. So I don't know if there is a problem with the red zone offense, but right there, it just I mean, it was the same problems you saw like it all night. Just, you know, they had to move that ball slowly down the field just to get him to that spot. And the play calling just got weird.
No, I think you're absolutely right. The play calling got baffling at times. You're looking at it and saying, why would you do any kind of spread option run here or anything like that? Just do the ground and pound. Damian Pierce had a nice game. Give him the ball more. I would love to see Damian Pierce get more, inside the tackle running opportunities. But this offense, for whatever reason, Dan Mullen does not like calling 27's number for those short runs too often.
I think he thinks that all three of his backs are physical enough to get him that yardage. But I do agree with you. He's their big power guy. You know, I don't know why he wouldn't get the short yardage plays, or at least have him in there to think he's going to get the ball and then use Emery to get you down there. For all the problems that Florida had on offense, they were right there with a chance to tie it. And that's the thing I think that's the most mind-boggling to me, is not being able to punch it in with 9 tries inside the 10. It's like when Georgia had it in 2018 and Florida stopped them 8 straight plays.
Yeah, I mean, look, this was a game and it was dominated by Florida. I mean, realistically, the entire game. Frank Frangie tweeted out, Frank Frangie from 1010XL in Jacksonville tweeted out, just think about this. Kentucky's offense tonight completed 7 passes for 211 total yards of offense, was 1 for 8 on third downs, and scored on 2 of their 11 possessions, and they beat Florida. Florida was the better team in this. Kentucky was the more opportunistic team.
You know, it's so funny. I was listening to it today. And so the last point we'll get off the offense, you know, speaking about Kentucky, they were mentioning that teams are getting all kinds of opportunities against them, but nobody is capitalizing. And then when Kentucky gets theirs, they're taking advantage of it. It's not like they're blowing teams out of the water, but like you said, they're opportunistic. You know, they have to be, because they turn the ball over a ton of times. I think they're still at -9, but now have a ton of turnovers on the season. So they have to get points when they get the ball, or when they get, you know, a chance to do so. But you mentioned how few yards Kentucky had, and that was partially due to the Florida defense. Usually Florida's bugaboo, I've mentioned this before, almost like the problems were inverted for Florida. Like the defense was always, not always, but the defense tended to be the issue, was when it was handcuffing the team. If they could just get that right or be at least average, Florida usually wins the game. This week, special teams, offense, not clicking, but your defense, you know, like you said, 1 for 9 on third down, 211 yards given up, 71 pass yards given up, with 41 of those being on a screen pass that was blocked excellently and probably a result of a couple bad angles in the secondary. But, you know, for the most part, when Florida needed to get stops, they got them on defense.
Right. And I mean, they even held, what's his name, Chris Rodriguez, to 99 yards.
Leading rusher in the SEC.
Right. And I mean, look, 99 yards is 99 yards, but it's how he got those. He had to work really, really hard on those 19 carries that he had. Overall, man, I was impressed with the Florida defense. If you had told me that I would wake up Sunday morning and that Florida will have lost, my natural instinct would have been like, well, what did Todd Grantham do? And he didn't do anything. He called a good game as far as I'm concerned.
Just interesting to see. Todd Grantham usually catches the heat, but he is not catching it today, or at least this week. It's all on Dan Mullen, the head coach. But I was also impressed. I think, you know, and people want to, you know, we still mention this. Kyrie Elam didn't play this game. They relied on Avery Helm and Jason Marshall to cover players in the secondary. You know, Trevez Johnson got a pick. He made a play in the secondary. So for all the problems the secondaries had, they stepped up that game for sure.
Yeah, for sure. And it was really nice. You alluded to the interception there. It was nice to see a turnover, wasn't it?
It was nice to see a pick.
Yeah.
You know, they hadn't had a pick since the USF game.
And Trevez Johnson, a good story. I'm glad that he was able to come away with it. It would have been nice if they could have, put some points on the board after, but it happens.
Well, that's another critical mistake that they had. Yeah. They get that ball at the 15 if Antonio Valentino doesn't commit the personal foul. Now, I wasn't able to see it. I was working the radio broadcast, so I was kind of in and out of looking at the TV. So I don't really know how bad it was, but all I know is that penalty put them back, and then they got the holding penalty to put them farther back. So they got a tempted field goal, and that's the one that gets blocked. It's weird right. how that just kind of one affected the other.
Right, and then how that momentum carried through the rest of the game. Kentucky now all of the momentum, all of the just the aggression on the sideline and everything. Yeah. It's really kind of interesting just how a game can swing on something like that, and how it swung on what was a positive for Florida that ended up, you know, with the personal foul and then, you know, everything that happened thereafter. And then it ended up being a negative for Florida at the end of the day. That's impressive. It's one of the things I think that makes sports so much fun and so interesting to all of us.
Yeah. That's what happens when you shoot yourself in the foot so many times, the foot's gone.
Absolutely.
You end up not having anything to stand on. So what do you think this loss means for Florida? Where do they go from here?
All right. So what the loss means is pretty simple. Barring a miracle, and I do mean the grandest of miracles, the playoff hopes are gone. The SEC championship hopes are gone. The SEC East championship is gone. And just so that everybody knows, it's not officially gone, that Florida would have to win out. Georgia would have to lose one additional game to the Florida game. But aside from all that, Kentucky also has to lose three games. So there's just so much that would have to happen.
You mentioned that. So I think Kentucky losing three games might be more likely than Georgia losing to Florida and then losing again.
Well, no, and I agree. That's the problem there is Georgia and Kentucky are going to play. And you don't obviously want them to tie, and there is no tie in college, but you know, one of those teams has to win. And so that's going to put a strangle grip on it. And that's kind of where you're at. It's just, ooh.
Well, Kentucky has a three-game stretch. They go to Sanford. I think they host LSU, and then they're in Starkville to play Mississippi State.
Right.
So that could be your three in a row right there.
It's possible. But then, like I said, you need Georgia to lose another game in addition to the game in Jacksonville.
I'm not holding out hope. That's probably less likely to happen than Kentucky losing three games.
Oh, I completely agree with that. The Kentucky game, the Kentucky team we saw yesterday, it's kind of like what I feel like we saw from Alabama here in Florida. The crowd carried the team into that game. And it's the way that works, the way that the home crowd can really carry you in college sports works different than pretty much any other sport out there, or, you know, any kind of professional level. But I think that Kentucky got as much motivation, as much a boost from the crowd as they could have. It was very similar to what Florida experienced when Alabama came here. I don't think that Florida is a 2-point conversion away from being at Alabama's level. And I don't think there's many Florida fans who would have watched on Saturday that would think the same thing either. But when you have 90,000 screaming fans, it makes a vast difference.
And it just makes you think, like, you know, with Dan Mullen, this is the third time, if you count both him and McElwain, that Florida's gone to Kroger Field and kind of, you know, screwed around and almost, you know, messed around and found out with an L. And this is the time that it happened. It's almost like it was karmic that they lost this game because they had so many problems. And Florida is the better team, but good teams beat better teams and they play terribly. And that's what happened. But you mentioned, this loss, and it's weird to think about Dan Mullen as a coach at Florida because he's done some great things. You know, he's pulled off some major highs. He's beaten LSU at home, beaten Auburn at home, beaten Georgia, gotten back to Atlanta. The big thing with this team was offense before he got in. But then you see some really dumb stuff, you know, not winning on the trail in recruiting, home losses to Kentucky and Missouri in 18, 2019, you lose to Georgia when you could have definitely won that game. And then in 2020, you lose to A&M on the road, a hobbled LSU team at home. And then you just get curb stomped by Oklahoma in the bowl game. So it's just a mishmash of just a average deal.
Man, if you're going to get me started on Coach Mullen, this could get south really quick. But try to keep it very simple. You know, I think I'm trying to think of a way to say this. It's just not going to spin off and spiral. But – it really, you mentioned it, the recruiting has been one big thing. And you know, I don't like recruiting. I don't follow it as much as I should probably. That's why we've got other people at the website that write about recruiting most of the time. But where Florida finishes in recruiting and what recruiting has proven to do, and if you have any questions about this, check out Will Miles over at Read and Reaction. Recruiting paves the way to championships. I admit that in the days of the transfer portal that strange things can happen. But at the end of the day, you still have to get some of that top talent. You know, if we had a 4-star offensive lineman across that line and Dan developed them into 5 stars, how much better would this team be? You can't tell me that recruiting doesn't matter. And every time that Dan gives that stupid, smug answer that, oh, we have our own rating system. Yeah, I saw it. 13 points at Kroger Field in Lexington. Congrats, Dan. You know, I get super annoyed. I think that the way that Dan answers questions bothers me. The way that he answered the question about if he was out coached, that bothers me. Not because I actually agree with him on the point that, yeah, Florida played a better game. Florida was the better team. He wasn't the better coach. You know, Nick Saban would have said right there, no, I wasn't the better coach. You look at the scoreboard. That's the better coach. Dan doesn't take that same accountability. And that's something that we've seen over the last one plus years now, is that accountability has just been taken completely away from this program when it comes to performance on the field. And when it comes to just his overall demeanor as the head coach, and recruiting's a small part of that. While we're talking about accountability and stuff like that, do you think that Anthony Richardson should have had more touches in the second half? He had one touch in the second half.
Gosh, I don't know, man.
And and you know what? I agree because I want to be like, no, Emory needed to get in a flow. Well, the offense was sputtering, and that's what makes me think, well, you know what? It couldn't have hurt, right?
it makes you think, like, you know, he's been a spark plug before, you know, and Emory wasn't playing terribly, but, you know, he could have had a chance for an explosive play with a guy like Anthony Richardson. I don't think he would have had fewer chances with a guy like Emory Jones, but just like, I think we've mentioned this before, things just happen when Anthony Richardson gets on the field.
Right.
But I think maybe Dan got a little scared that it was gonna be too big for him, or that he was just going out there doing the same thing he was doing even before he got his hamstring hurt. Either way, just weird to see a talent like that not get at least a couple more touches.
I was surprised.
He could have been great on that in the inside the 10. You know, you want to run quarterback power, all sorts of stuff like that.
That's what I don't understand. You've got two very talented quarterbacks who are very talented running the ball. Why don't you put them both on the field? Surely there's packages where they are both on the field at the same time. We've seen other schools do it.
Yeah, so there have been teams that do it. You know, you mentioned Ole Miss when they had Matt Corral, they used John Rhys Plumlee.
Right.
Also on the baseball team, you know, they'd get him in there as a gadget player. I remember Penn State back in the day, it was only a few years ago. Trace McSorley was the quarterback, and they would use backup quarterback Tommy Stevens as sort of an H-back role, wide receiver kind of deal. So, I mean, even here at Florida, Trey Burton, he was a quarterback, switched to that, you know, H-back, do-it-all Swiss Army knife kind of player. So you can definitely do it. Is Dan comfortable with it? I don't know, man. But either way, you just hate to see a guy. You know, and it's not that I think Anthony's better. It's like we've speculated about this man's leg for 2 weeks.
Right.
Maybe 3 weeks, actually. And we see him 4 times in the game. Like, but he just didn't look the same when he was out there, not running the same.
Well, and I think part of that comes to the defense was really keying in on him in the running game. And we saw this the whole game, the entire time. They had 8 guys in the box almost the entire game. They dared Florida to pass the ball. And that's part of why I was so frustrated that there wasn't the deep shots. I don't have any excuses for it. I think if you get Anthony out there, let him throw a couple of passes. You know, I know he's thrown a couple of the deep ones down the sideline to Copeland, but if you let him throw some of those intermediate routes, unless you think that he can't, if Dan Mullen just doesn't think that he can throw the ball right now, then okay, the point's moot. That's kind of where we're at. I would like to know what's going on, because I mean, whether Dan likes it or not, on Twitter and on Facebook right now, there's all kinds of debate as to whether somebody else should be the quarterback of this team, whether it's fair or not. Like, neither one of us seem to think that Emery did a horrible job and that he should be benched for his performance. But we all, even you and I, were talking about, there is certainly a player that when he comes on the field, it seems to be more explosive.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and I'm not going to say that I want Anthony out there, and I'm not going to, you know, I don't want people to think into this comparison too much, but it's almost similar to that Kelly Bryant, Trevor Lawrence situation that Dabo had, you know. And, you know, we'll mention this and then we'll move on to something else about the Gators. But, you know, it's that, you know, with Kelly Bryant's the starter. He has done nothing to lose you a game. The only game you have lost with him in the whole game was the semifinal against Alabama. That Syracuse game that they lost, he got knocked out. Not his fault. He didn't do anything to lose the job on the field, it seemed, when they started the year in 2018. But then all of a sudden, Dabo just knew. I mean, he just knew he had to make the change, or he just knew that something had to be done. He had to go with the guy that he brought in here and was, you know, what a lot of people thought was the better quarterback, and he just pulled the trigger on it.
But, Jake, do you trust Dan Mullen to make that move if he needs to?
No, because Felipe
that's the problem
for a year and a half.
Right. We saw this literally 2 years ago, this exact scenario. And
it's just you didn't know what you were going to get from Kyle Trask when he was out there because he barely played so much.
Right. But at the same token, when Dabo made that switch, he didn't know exactly what he was getting. He knew what he had in Kelly Bryant, but he did not know exactly what he had in Trevor Lawrence, except that he was a high-rated prospect, and whatever he was doing in practice was obviously better than what Kelly Bryant was offering. Now, it's possible that Dan's not seeing. Maybe Kyle Trask was not as good in practice. I've heard otherwise, but who knows?
Yeah, I don't know. There's those guys who are really good in practice and really good on the field, really good in practice and not good on the field. Just absolutely terrible in practice and amazing on the field, and then suck at both. Right. But moving on, you know, we're mentioning some big questions here. What questions do you have about this team going forward, especially heading into the Vanderbilt week, potential get right game for the Gators?
Yeah. The biggest question I have is who's going to step up as a leader for this program. This is a really weird time for this team because, like we just talked about, they're kind of out of the race. It is the first weekend in October. There is a lot of football to be played and still a lot of good football to be played. Who are the leaders that are going to step up and not let the young guys kind of lose the focus of where they are at, what there is still to play for? And that, you know, the name on the back of the jersey is going to be just as important as the name on the front of the jersey moving forward, because they still need to put their best tape out there so that whether they're playing here or whether they're playing elsewhere, they're going to have the best tape possible, and their best tape is going to serve Florida in its best interest as well.
Yeah. I think that's when you see guys like, you know, a Zachary Carter and Emory Jones, a Trey Dean, you know, even a Ventrell Miller, even though that he's out, like, you're going to see guys like them, even the transfers like Valentino and Newkirk, that's when they have to step up and sort of get the guys, you know, recalibrated, get them focused so they don't come out. You know, it's going to be really hard to have a stinker against Vanderbilt. A stinker might be like a 30-0 win, but, you know, just make sure they're refocused and ready, because they have to get right before they go to Baton Rouge the week after.
Right. Well, that's I kind of fear that we're going to wake up Sunday morning, or we're going to be talking next week and we're going to say, oh yeah, everything's good again. No, it's just Vanderbilt. Who knows? I hope I'm wrong in that this team is really going to learn from this and take what they've learned, and it's going to just be put to use. But I could totally see a scenario where Dan Mullen goes with the vanilla play call that we saw the first two games. Hold on. It's been vanilla all year. Nothing changed.
He's kind of a little exotic. He got exotic in the Alabama game. He showed some stuff in the – he might have shown more stuff in the Tennessee game than he did in the Kentucky game.
No, I completely agree with that. I think that's part of the problem.
I think – and, you know, it's funny. You know, I was thinking about this the other day – today when I was writing something. I was thinking, when Dan's been in a spot – and he wanted to get some momentum, or he wanted to get the ball back, or he wanted to have a spark, what'd he do? Bust out the trick play. What happens? You know, Mississippi State, they're trying to get in the end zone, trying to take the lead. It's tied at 6-6. What's he do? Kodak. Kadarius Toney to Dante Lang, or Morrill Stevens, you know, touchdown Florida. Florida is able to hang on for the win. Miami, they stall on their first drive. What's he do? Fake punt with Tommy Townsend gets you the first down. Keep the drive going. And then the Tennessee game. Offense, not really clicking. You're down 14 to 10. Not down 14, and you're up only 17 to 14. You want to make it, you know, a 10-point game. Hey, we're calling audible, switching to Kodak, run the same play, gets in the end zone. You walk away with the win from there. So it was interesting, you know, maybe just because they were on the road and you didn't want to chance it or something, or you just didn't feel comfortable running it with all the noise that was going on. But it was interesting, you know, thinking back that he didn't call some kind of splash play possibility.
Yeah. I mean, I would have taken almost anything. I thought it was a very vanilla playbook. How many times we're going to run the quarterback right up the middle of the field, right up the center and the guard. Something
that's
that
the
Kentucky,
damn own offense, man.
Right. But unfortunately it wasn't effective. You know, third down and two, that's exactly what they're expecting. We're playing right into their defense. That's a problem.
He was calling that even when Kyle Trask was taking snaps. So
he's been calling that since Dan Mullen was a quarterback here. Okay. or since Tim Tebow.
So, I mean, it's just part of his offense.
Right. But sometimes you got to get a little bit unique with it. And that's a situation to do so.
My question, you know, and I think it's a question a lot of people have, where do we go from here? In terms of quarterback usage, you know, will we see more of Anthony Richardson this week rather than last week? And could he even give Anthony, you know, a whole half or a whole quarter or something like that by himself? It'll just be interesting to see how he handles this going forward, because, I mean, Anthony's only going to get more and more healthy unless he has a setback.
Right. And I think that one possibility is that they might alternate series. I think that's very real possible. Very real possibility moving forward that they're going to alternate series, and you know, the best guy will emerge in spring camp next year, and the other guy will be off the roster most likely, in my opinion.
Which will just be terrible, because you hate to see a guy like Emory Jones wait for his spot. If he potentially loses it, then he's got to leave anyway, even though he refused to transfer for 4 years. You would hate to see a kid like Anthony Richardson, the hometown kid, have to leave if one of them transfers. I don't know if they will. This is speculation. We don't know anything.
No. But these guys, they've pined for each other. We've seen on social media that they've got each other's back. But I mean, that seems like the obvious scenario, I think.
I think that's just the way college football has gone. You know,
yeah, that's the world we live in.
guy who, you know, thinks he's a very talented player, doesn't get the time he wants, he's going to find a place that's going to play him.
Absolutely.
You know, but yeah, you know, Florida this weekend, not the only top 25 team to lose. They're actually one of nine, Brian, to get to lose. So run down the list a little bit here. Arkansas proved to be a fraud. They played Georgia on the road in Sanford, lost 37-0. They dropped 13. Ole Miss loses 42-21. They were ranked 12. They're now 17 in that loss to Alabama. Number three, Oregon on the road in Palo Alto, loses to unranked Stanford in overtime. They now drop to 8. Notre Dame hosting Cincinnati, who was number 7. They lose 24-13. They now drop to 14 in the AP poll. Texas A&M ranked 15th. They lose to Mississippi State. They're now out of the top 25 after that 26-22 loss. Baylor loses to Oklahoma State. They are now unranked as well in that 24-14 loss. UCLA loses 42-23 to Arizona State, who is back in the top 25. But UCLA is now unranked, and Fresno State loses to Hawaii. You know, Fresno State was kind of almost a giant killer for a while. They beat UCLA on the road, and they lose 27-24 to the Rainbow Warriors, and they are now unranked. A couple other things notable in the rankings. Florida drops from number 10 to number 20 with the loss. Kentucky jumps all the way to 16 for being unranked. Penn State's at 4. Iowa is at 3 with Georgia at 2 and Alabama at 1 to round out your top 4. Cincinnati right below them at 5. Michigan State, I don't think anybody expected Michigan State to be this good, but here they are sitting at number 11 with one of the best running backs in the country in Kenneth Walker. SMU, they pummeled USF over the weekend. They're now at 24. And Auburn pulls out some stupid piece of crap win when they completely screw over TJ Finley, and Bo Nix is back where he thinks he belongs, and that's operating the Auburn offense somehow. They're at 18, and Clemson out of the top 25 after barely escaping with a win against Boston College.
Bo Nix is that guy who he just seems to come back. Every time you think he's down and out, you're like, nope. And he comes back and has just a heroic game. He had a great game for Auburn this weekend. But, yeah, if you're TJ Finley, man, you've got to be saying, what the heck?
what else do I have to do?
You mentioned Arkansas, who rose all the way up to 8 last week. Jake, did you think 8 was kind of high for them entering this week's action?
I think it was just based on the way they were winning games. You know, they were – I mean, the A&M game was not a dominant win. They won 20-10. I think it's more on the fact that they just completely beat the crap out of Texas. You know, but when you have two ranked wins, as early in the season, you're going to get in the top 10.
Hey, 8 just seemed kind of high to me. And obviously, with a 37-0 loss, it was kind of high. The other thing, oh. I'm glad to see Notre Dame lose because I hate seeing them in the college football playoff. And now we don't have to worry about that because much like Florida, their season's pretty much over. Exciting thing on this week's docket, you mentioned that number 3 Iowa and number 4 Penn State. Well, those two teams are going to play against each other this week. And that's going to be at Iowa. It should be pretty fun. The game's at 4 o'clock p.m. So Gator fans might be able to watch it because the Gator game's at noon. But yeah, no, that's kind of my takes of the top 25. Like you said, the biggest thing out of it is I'm really glad that Notre Dame lost and we won't have to worry about seeing the Fighting Irish. And
my take is top 4 matchup. Okay. And we're playing this game at 4 o'clock. That is, I believe Iowa City is Central Time. It's 3 o'clock Central Time. Why is this not at night?
Well, you know, the Big Ten actually puts their primetime games on at noon. And so I'm glad it's not at noon.
I don't know why Fox does this. It's the dumbest thing it's just stupid. And it's not just Fox. Iowa State was also at 4 o'clock. I don't know why we're playing these games. Arkansas, now I know why Arkansas, Georgia was at noon because they wanted you to stay on that channel all day.
Right.
But I can't, like, if you got a big game, the game should be at night. That's just my opinion.
All right, Jake. I got a little bit of a hot take about all top 25 polls, okay?
Okay, all right.
Yeah, we should not have any until about November 1st, you know, about 10 or so weeks into the season, because it's all garbage. Arkansas is a perfect example of that. and I think preseason polls are one of the worst things that are in college sports at all, because it's based primarily on previous years, and current year success has very little in the way of the preseason polls. What do you think of that?
I'm inclined to agree with you. You know, people are like, I remember, you know, I'll tell my dad so-and-so, some teams are ranked. He's like, they're ranked that high. I'm like, well, we'll see what happens when the CFP poll comes out in, you know, 5 weeks or something. You know, I feel like all of these ratings are arbitrary because we have a second set of polls that are going to come out, you know, by, you know, whatever week it is. So all of these are just nothing, like you said. You know, yeah. it's just kind of, especially preseason rankings. Like, you know, there's some people who believe nobody should be ranked to start the year.
And Jake, this should probably be mentioned, you know, down later on in the season, but since we're on the talk now, I would much rather have the BCS than a group of people making the playoff committee. What do you think of that?
You know, I have made this argument before that the BCS was, the CFP has been no better than the BCS in terms of providing people with some sense of, I don't want to say relief, but some sense that it's being done right. Because, right, you know, the BCS, for all of its problems, would pull this, or for all of the things that we think it's better for, would pull this dumb thing out, and, you know, and you would get a 2-loss LSU in the national title game.
Right.
They ended up winning the national title, but that's beside the point. But people were mad because the computers weren't factoring in all these different things and they weren't ranking teams right. Well, now we got humans picking them and they ain't ranking them right either.
They're actually worse.
So it makes you wonder what, like you said, rankings are just an absolute mess of a thing and nobody will ever be satisfied with them. but it's interesting that we're like, yes, we finally have a playoff. And then we're like, boo, the playoff sucks.
Yeah. And Cincinnati right now has to be saying, well, hey guys, what can we do to get in? Because, you know, they're sitting on the outside looking in right now. And I get, you know, they're matching up the 3-4 this week. So they're going to have an opportunity to rise, but what voters are going to vote for them to continue to into the playoff? I don't think there's really a path for Cincinnati, even if they go undefeated, even with the win over Notre Dame. Any thoughts on that?
I think this week, you know, after that Penn State Iowa game, since he's going to slide into the top four, if they keep winning, they're going to make it.
The rest of their schedule sucks.
I don't even know what it is. Can you read it off for me really quick?
All right. You ready for this?
Yeah.
We got the Juggernaut Temple out of Philadelphia. That's in Cincinnati. Don't go Owls.
Shout out Brett Holcomb.
1-3 Navy. That's at Annapolis. Then they travel to 1-4 Tulane.
Oh, man, I really thought the Green Wave would be good this year.
I did too. I think they have a good offense, but their defense is not very good. From there, they have a home game against 1-4 Tulsa.
Oh, yeah. Go Golden Hurricane.
Then they're traveling to Tampa to take on your 1-4 South Florida Bulls.
Oh, good God. Do they play a team above 500 the rest of the year?
They do have the weekend before Thanksgiving. They do have a big matchup against a current 5-0 SMU Mustangs before ending the season at East Carolina.
Game day. That's a game day game. If SMU stays ranked, they're going to game day there.
All right. I'm not holding my breath for SMU to stay ranked, but you know, they have the benefit of playing very similar schedule to Cincinnati. But I look at that schedule and I'm just like, there's no way that, you know, they're going to get in over Georgia. For example, if Georgia has one loss in the SEC championship game against Alabama, I don't see a path for Cincinnati to make the playoff.
No, I can see it because I think they're going to keep ranking them at 4 after this week. Whichever of these two teams that in the Big Ten, they run the table and they win out, they're going to go. They'll be your number 2. We're just going to assume Georgia's making it to the SEC title game to play Alabama. That'll be that'll knock one of those two teams off, and they'll go to 4, and that's your top 4 right there.
Well, we'll see. Who knows? This is it's going to be a fun year, right?
Unless Michigan,
even if you're not a Florida fan, that's going to be a fun year, right?
Yeah, I think this is probably. I don't know if it's parody or just nobody's good. Remember, it's so funny. I remember when the playoff first came out, and they're like, you know, you got Alabama, Ohio State, Florida State was in there, Oregon was in there. Like, oh my gosh, everybody's in. All of these teams are good. Florida State sucked. I'm not going to say that they're good, but you know, we got representation. Oh my gosh, we're finally doing it right. And then every year since, you know, that year was pretty good too. It was Oklahoma. It was Clemson. It was Alabama. And oh gosh, Michigan State, I want to say, was in that semifinal, you know, another good year. But every year since, it's slowly just deteriorated in terms of, you know, not just quality of the CFP matchups, but the quality of everybody below the top 4.
I'm excited to see a little bit of parity or as close to parity as you can get in college football. With Clemson having kind of a down year, that's going to give teams opportunities, teams that we haven't seen. You've got Penn State and Iowa in the conversation right now. That's fun. For your regular college football fan, this is a great thing.
And I hope Penn State makes all the way, because I'm still mad that Ohio State made the playoff ahead of them in 2016.
Yeah, for sure. Trust me, I know. but yeah, no, that's I'm excited about it. It should be a fun finish. Unfortunately, Florida is not going to count into the playoff bracketing, but they can have some say if they can go in and beat Georgia. They can make that path a little bit more difficult for Georgia, as most Florida fans like to tout that 1980 number at Georgia fans. So they're going to need to continue that, and it's going to start with a game in Jacksonville.
If Florida wants to make the SEC title game, they're going to need to pray to every god they know, and maybe develop some new ones for that, so that Kentucky can lose 3 games in a row, and that you beat Georgia, and then you just got to hope Bo Nix does some Bo Nix stuff. Like, you just have to hope that the Bo Nix that played in LSU, which I would argue didn't play well, but the Bo Nix that just did irreverent, dumb, great value Johnny football things shows up to play the Bulldogs and you beat Georgia in Jacksonville.
So, absolutely.
So, I mean, that'll do it for the Gridiron Girl podcast. Brian, do you have anything you want to add?
No, man, I appreciate you having me on this week. Unfortunately, Mark was unavailable, but you know, we're pressing on even without him, and I'm sure he'll be back next week.
Yes. So you can find me at Jake_hit06. That's Jake_HITT06. Where can they find you, Brian?
At Chomp Talk Brian, Chomp Talk Brian.
Yes, and you can find his work at chomptalk.com. You can find mine at InsideTheGators.com. And that'll wrap it up for us today on the Gridiron Growl podcast, brought to you by Chomp Talk. I'm Jake Hitt for Mark McLeod and Brian Fox. We'll see you later.